Good evening. Welcome to the Round Church. My name is David Illman, co-director of Christian Heritage here. We thank you for coming, and tonight we have a special event. 30 years, actually to this day, 30 years, Francis Schaeffer passed away. And he's a very special man to all of us here at Christian Heritage. You may not know, but Ronald McCauley, who will be speaking tonight, is the founder of Christian Heritage, and also son-in-law of Francis Schaeffer himself. And without further ado, just want to welcome Brennan McCauley.
I must get my watch suitably positioned because we are going to be squeezed for time. And let me add my warm welcome to David's. I just wanted to say three things by way of general introduction as we begin. The first is that last year we had a similar memorial or honoring of C.S. Lewis. And that gave us the idea for this. It was the 50th anniversary of C.S. Lewis's death. And you may wonder about the juxtaposition of these two people, Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis. It might seem a little strange to put them in the same bracket, but I think they do belong in many ways, even though the name Schaeffer is not anything like as well known as C.S. Lewis for various reasons. I was surprised, though, because obviously one wonders, well, why would we do this for Francis Schaeffer? We did it for C.S. Lewis. Why do it for Francis Schaeffer? I was surprised to see the latest biography of Schaeffer by the professor of systematic theology at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, say that he had, as a young man, although deeply indebted to Schaeffer and hugely admiring of him and his work, that he hesitated to put him amongst the truly great. And when I say that, names that he mentioned were Luther and Calvin and Augustine and so on. Now, whether you agree with him or not, he said as he's grown older and he's now near retirement age, he does see him in that sort of class. So that is in black and white. You can see his biography, a very, very interesting introduction to Schaeffer's ideas. But that's one thing I wanted to mention in terms of just why we're doing this. That at the very least, you could say that he was amongst the five or six really important Christian writers, thinkers in the 20th century. The second thing I wanted to say was that we really do not want this to be hagiographic. If you don't know what that word means, hagios is a saint, and you know in the medieval period, there are all kinds of exaggerated stories told about the saints, fables, most legends, many of them. And we have absolutely no interest in that. Many of us involved tonight are actually those who lived alongside Schaeffer, and we are only too aware of his limitations and his idiosyncrasies and so on. So that's the second thing. The other thing is that as I stand here, I just wish that all we're doing in honor of Francis Schaeffer, we could do for Edith, his wife. And I hear you say, affirming that. And it's sad that we haven't been able to. You may not know this, but she died just over a year ago at the age of 99. That by way of general introduction. In terms of the personal introduction, I can't say how grateful I am to Oz Guinness for coming. He actually had to go back to the States and return. He was just going to make one journey, so he's now made two journeys in order to be here tonight. And so a very, very special thank you to Oz. Like me, he was a young graduate when he first went to the Swiss Library. There was only the one Swiss Library, Switzerland. And like me, apart from the fact that I got maritally involved, his life was completely changed, like mine was, and the whole direction of his life changed by his time there in Switzerland. And somewhat reluctantly, he's been prepared to change his subject to dealing with this key idea in Schaeffer's writing, which Schaeffer called true truth. So Oz is going to be speaking on that. And nothing could be more appropriate in my view, because this is really one of the central things in Schaeffer's thinking. And without that, one doesn't really understand him. At the same time, however, equally at the center of what Schaeffer was trying to say, was an idea which he described as true spirituality. In fact, he wrote a book with that title. And in the introduction, he says, really, this should have been the first book to appear. Sadly, it came further down the track. And I mention this because on one hand, we're going to have quite an introduction about Labri, which was the work that Schaefer began as a result of his understanding of this concept of true spirituality. And I'm glad that Andrew from the Labri in Hampshire, my colleague down there, is going to be speaking on that in a minute. But both of us have chosen this title very deliberately, The Real Schaefer. And I say this because there has been a huge amount of misunderstanding of Schaefer, and not even just that, but real active misrepresentation of him by some who have been very close to him. And I think that one of the misrepresentations and one of the misunderstandings is the fact that he is so easily read, and for obvious reasons. I mean, his books were The God Who Is There, Escape from Reason, How Should We Then Live, etc. These books were dealing with the big intellectual issues of the day, etc. But many people have forgotten this other aspect, this other center, if I could put it that way, namely true spirituality. And I am convinced that the genius of was involved in his life and work, as with Edith, was the combination of these two things. The combination of true spirituality and true truth. And I'm going to try to illustrate that as we go along. The third personal introduction is to a visitor from the States, Dr. Greg Jessen, who's very kindly come over to be involved tonight and over the next couple of days. And he is a professor of philosophy at the Luther College in Iowa. And I'm going to be interviewing him after Andrew has spoken, and that'll be the end of our first session until the break. Okay? So much for the introductions. As I begin, what I want to say, I want to hang everything around two anecdotes. The first involves myself meeting the Schaefers here in Cambridge back when I was an undergraduate at the end of my second year doing law here. The second involves how Schaefer actually became a Christian, which is a remarkable story which very few people know. And in the case of my first, incident, it all happened on the first Wednesday of June back in 1958. Labri had by that stage been in existence since April the 1st, note the date, 1955, so it was in its infancy, Labri was. And the Schaefers were visiting London for a week, I think it was, maybe 10 days. And a very dear friend of ours who had been to the Labri in Switzerland and stayed with the Schaefers just overnight, she arrived on the evening bus and she left the next morning early. And she had very big questions about the Bible and its reliability, etc., etc. And those hours, you can imagine how many there were, changed her life. She was so excited when she came back. She was teaching in London. She phoned us here in Cambridge. She said, the Schaefers are coming soon. You must meet them. We deferred. We tried to put this off. But finally she said, I bought the tickets. They're coming Wednesday afternoon. So my dear friend Michael Casti gathered a few of us together. And at the top of C staircase in St. Catherine's College, on that Wednesday in June 1958, I had been playing a hockey match, rushed in. We didn't know who they were. We were highly suspicious. They lived somewhere near Co, and all that represented to us was moral rearmament, you know, and all that. So we didn't know what we were to expect. And I don't think they did. And after we'd had tea, et cetera, Edith finally said, Fran, aren't you going to say something to these young men? There were about half a dozen of us in the room. And he was reluctant to begin with, and then he held up his right hand like this, and he said, I'll talk on this. The supernatural is right here. You can imagine how bewildered we were by this introduction. And then what he started to do was to unpack what was basically the content of the books like Escape from Reason, The God Who Is There, just showing, tracing how the Enlightenment, with all its optimism, that by giving up God, giving up revelation in the Bible and so on, turning away from all of that tradition, superstition, was going to introduce a wonderful new era in the world's history. And then he just tracked what had happened in actual fact in what he called, those of you who are familiar with his books, the line of despair. Now, I had just come out of that background myself, having been an atheist, and realizing that life was just totally meaningless if this is really all that's left, you see. So he did that, and it was my first introduction to anything of that nature, and we were all just utterly stunned that somebody was entering into this domain. It was very distant, it seemed to us, from Bible study, etc., etc. Do you get it? What I didn't realize was that that very expression, the supernatural is right here, was also expressive of this other reality, this other center, true spirituality. So the Schaeffers were saying both, it's really true intellectually, and if you turn away from this, it's disaster, intellectually and morally and culturally, etc. But we need to live in the light of that reality. So the supernatural is not just an idea, but and Andrew will expand on this. It's not just an idea, but we have to live within the reality of prayer and the support and the comfort we receive from what he used to describe a moment-by-moment relationship with the living Christ. That was his favorite phrase. A moment-by-moment relationship with the living Christ. This is what lay behind, you see, beginning of Labrie. All of this had happened by the time Labrie began. I'm still okay. I'm hoping to give you a chronology. If I run out of time, I'll just leave that. Because some of you may not know anything about Schaeffer and his life, and I'll try to cover that. The second incident is his conversion. He was 17 in 1929, and his mother had been a churchgoer and was insistent that he should go to Sunday school. So he would go to Sunday school. But he wasn't getting anything very much out of that. But it had introduced him to the Scout movement, and he'd had wonderful experiences through that, being taken on expeditions, etc., etc., introduced to music, art, through that. And his Sunday school teacher suggested that he might earn a little bit of money by doing conversation expression for a Russian emigre, you know, giving him an opportunity to just speak English. So he started to do this, and he realized after a very short while that the text that this man was trying to learn English from, which was the unexpurgated version of St. Catherine the Great's biography, wasn't going to help him very much. So he trekked into the town, to the city, to a bookshop called Leary's, and he went in and he explained his situation. He said, I just need a sort of a primer, you know, an easy sort of beginning book for someone who's learning English. Well, he walked out of the shop with this book in his bag, and he got home to discover he'd been given the wrong book. And Schaeffer was just constantly overwhelmed by the providence of God in this, because you won't guess what the book turned out to be. It wasn't the Bible. It was Greek and Latin philosophy. So he found this book, and he started to read it, and he described it to me as, you know, like a duck taking to water. These were the questions that just fascinated him. So where has everything come from? Is there a God? How do you know what's right and wrong and so on? So he started to devour this when he wondered, how does all this relate to the Bible? You see? I hear all this stuff in Sunday school. It doesn't seem to make much sense to me. But I better read the Bible now for myself before I sort of jettison it completely. So he picked up the Bible and he started to read the Bible. So he read, you know, alternately Ovid and folk like that, and then he would read the Bible. And this is really clear. This is not by hearsay. He said before he entered into Genesis 4, he had realized from the questions posed by the philosophers that the Bible had, theoretically, if it were true, an answer. So all the big questions were being answered by this book. So he then wondered what to do. So, and he had to do this secretly because parents didn't want him to stay up late. He's in the house and waste electricity and all that. And so he started to read the Bible more than the classical philosophers. And by the time he got to the end of the Old Testament, he was already, in a sense, a Christian believer, because the story was all just so obvious, you know, where it's heading, the Messiah, etc., etc. Now, I say this, again, very deliberately, because another of the misunderstandings about Schaeffer is that here is this intellectualist, you know, and if you're going to get anywhere, you've got to become well-read in philosophy and culture and all the rest. Schaeffer was not like that. He was just persuaded that Christianity was true. No one was helping him. He just saw that this is the nature of what the Bible is about. It is talking about the real universe and giving us the answer. So it's not, it doesn't arise out of human thinking. It arises from the revelation of God. Hence his book, the title of which was He Is There and He Is Not Silent. And it's absolutely vital to understand that he was, in this sense, just a simple Bible-believing Christian. And so is Edith. Right? I hope I've made these points clear. As I come to a close, let me just hurry through the chronology, because it is interesting. I can make comment a lot as I go. And then, of course, later on, if Oz and Andrew want to add anything, and Greg, they can do that. This will give you a framework. As I told you, he was converted in 1929, just before the Depression, right? One of the people he met shortly after his conversion was a Presbyterian elder and saw his ability and suggested that he have a training. So he went to university in Virginia, Hampton, Sydney, and he got very, very high marks in that. And he then served as a Presbyterian pastor in three churches, the last of which was in St. Louis in Missouri. And at that point, he was asked by a group of churches in the States to come over to Europe to support churches in the aftermath of the Second World War. So in 1947, he came over on his own, leaving the family. He was away, I think, for about 2 months. And the idea was to try to see what the needs were so that the churches in the United States could be a support. And as he went around, there was, of course, this obvious problem of neo-orthodoxy creeping in, Karl Barth, etc., etc. So that was part of what he was doing. But anyway, he then went back, and they were then sent by these churches to Europe, and that is why they arrived as a family in 1948 in Switzerland. And they based themselves there because they were doing this peripatetic work. And at that point, they went into the mountains because it was cheaper, and people had said, you know, the rent is much cheaper up in the mountains. And they went to this beautiful village called Champéry under the mountains, the Dent du Midi. And that's where they stayed. And they fell in love with it. And they decided they would stay all the year round. And so Susan, my wife, who's here somewhere, and the other children were able to enjoy this beautiful countryside, the mountains, and they walked and played in the fields, etc. I have a Swiss just in front of me who's nodding his head. So this was their environment. And then they went back on furlough. And when they returned, that is when what Edith describes as the Labrie story happened. And just in a nutshell, they were expelled by the authorities of the canton of Valais, which was a Catholic canton, because of the conversion of a man by the name of Georges Exonery, who was actually an atheist. And being expelled, then they were expelled from the whole of Switzerland. But in order to make an appeal, they had to move to another canton, a Protestant canton called Vaud, and make their appeal from there. So that's what happened. I can't tell you the whole story. It's a whole book. It's called The Labrie Story. And the way God led them, here is the supernatural right here. They just knelt down on the floor together as a family. They said, Lord, if you want us to stay here, you can do it. You can overcome even the Swiss government. And that's what happened. So that was how Labrie began. And they found themselves in this little village called Weimar, which isn't even on the map, if you know what I mean. And so there they were, and people started to arrive. My brother-in-law was one of them, atheist, typical, and became a Christian. Many others like that, you see? And that's how it all snowballed. The next thing, and I'm drawing to a close, is that LaBrie began in that way, as I said, April 1955. The Shavers didn't know what they were going to do. Andrew will tell you more about what happened. The next thing I wanted to mention is that Time magazine got hold of what was happening. And I'm not quite sure how all that happened, but suddenly there he was, his photograph in the religious section of Time magazine, with the writing underneath saying, Billy Graham to the intellectuals, something like that. It certainly wasn't what Schaefer was thinking himself. He always was very careful to say, I'm not a philosopher, etc. I'm basically just an evangelist. He was so, that was his passion, was to try to make it clear to people that Christianity was really true so that they would believe. Then came the books. I'm hurrying to conclusion. Following the books, a lot of travel, etc., etc. Then came these two big documentary series, How Should We Then Live? And also Whatever Happened to the Human Race. And at the very end of the filming, here's my last point before I hand over to Andrew, at the very end of that, it was obvious that he was very ill. And that's when cancer was diagnosed. He had about 6 or 7 years after that before he died, as we said, 15th of May, 1984, in Rochester, Minnesota, which is where Mayo Clinic, which is where he was getting his treatment. So as I conclude, the misunderstandings still exist, that this is all just intellectual stuff. So do remember this, the true truth and true spirituality. And then I can only just mention this hurriedly, his influence was vast. And we just keep bumping into it. I'm sure those of you who know a bit about Schaefer have the same experience. And it's just lovely. It is not planned. The Schaefers started the work, as you'll now hear, with this principle that we're not going to try to build a big empire. We're just going to try to be faithful to the Lord. And the influence has just spread extraordinarily. Andrew, over to you.
A huge honor for me to be here tonight to celebrate the life of Francis Schaefer. I never met him, unlike Ronald, who's a son-in-law. So I never had the privilege of meeting Schaefer, but he's had a huge influence on me. So I feel it a huge honor to be able to address you on this man's life. I think 30 years after his death, we can begin to weigh his legacy. Begin. Now, only the Lord knows the full extent of that legacy, and I think if Schaefer were here himself, he wouldn't be that interested in his own legacy. And if the legacy was talked about, he'd say all the accolades of this legacy belong to the Lord. That's the way he was. But it is a considerable legacy, and I want to say two introductory points about this legacy. First of all, Schaefer's legacy is the legacy of a reformer. I see this man fundamentally as a reformer, and he stands in the stream of reformers that the Lord has raised up through the history of the church. Augustine, Luther, there's been a number of them, and Schaefer was very much in that line, a reformer, to bring renewal to the church. He wasn't wanting to invent something new. He wasn't an innovator. He wasn't trying to be novel. As Lewis would put it, he was trying, not cutting down jungles, he was simply irrigating deserts. And I think he wanted to recover what had been lost. He wanted to restore something. And he stood very self-consciously within the historic stream of the church. There's a new brand of church entrepreneur today who wants to be novel, wants to be progressive. That wasn't where Schaefer was coming from. He was a reformer. Then the second thing I'd say about his legacy as a general point is that it was remarkable for its comprehensiveness. The sheer reach of his legacy is really quite staggering. Now, many would begin, as Ronald has said, by thinking about his legacy in the realm of ideas, his legacy as an intellectual. And his contribution here really was very significant. He was attempting, and I think successful with many, at rescuing a historic understanding of truth. That it's possible to describe reality in a rational way that really corresponds with the way things are. And he was passionate about that and made a remarkable contribution to that whole subject. But his legacy goes far beyond that. We shouldn't forget his contribution to issues related to the sanctity of life. His contribution to pro-life issues. as modernity made the slaughter of the innocents acceptable and even lawful, Schaeffer stood up and said to the church, we have to stand up and speak to this issue. And we have to give something reasonable as to why this is wrong. And he did this at a moment when the church was largely sleeping, when these horrific things were taking place. Remarkable legacy there. I think his legacy in the realm of the arts was remarkable. Schaeffer stood within the Reformation heritage, the Protestant Reformation heritage, and that is very rich when it comes to the arts. And yet here we were in the middle of the 20th century, and most Christians thought that the arts were worldly, that they should be shunned. And Schaeffer came as a reformer into that situation and recovered a Christian aesthetic and encouraged many people in the arts to do their craft well. We could think about his contribution and legacy in the realm of environmentalism. He was way ahead of his time there and saw that because creation had a creator, it was meaningful, it had purpose, therefore it needed to be stewarded in a careful way by Christians. He wanted us to stand up in this realm too. Now, I could go on. I'm touching a few of some of the areas where his legacy was truly remarkable. I want to propose tonight that the most remarkable legacy he left, the most substantial one, is La Brie. And that's the subject I've been asked to talk about. I've worked in La Brie for 20 years. And all of us who work in La Brie have a profound sense of this legacy which is passed on to us by the Schaeffers. It's a living legacy, and it's remarkable. Now, this isn't self-serving, self-promoting. I simply want to talk about what the Schaeffers did in terms of the founding of La Brie. La Brie is a name attached to a movement that's gone to various parts of the world. It's small, it's quiet, there's about 9 branches, but each are industriously doing their thing. And there's a far-reaching influence that continues with La Brie to this day. And it's part of Schaeffer's living legacy. Now, as Ronald mentioned, it was started by Francis and Edith Schaeffer and their children in 1955. And La Brie basically was just an open door through which, over the last 5-6 decades, thousands upon thousands of people have passed through. It's a place where many unbelievers have become Christians. It's a place where many doubters have gained confidence in terms of what they believe. And it's a place where many broken people have received a remarkable degree of care and practical support. Now, in terms of Schaeffer's legacy, I think you can see La Brie as the practical outworking of what this man passionately believed. Now, I said I've never met Schaeffer, but I know this about Schaeffer. He was a passionate man. A very passionate man. And of course, passion today is in vogue, isn't it? We're all told to find our passions. And passion, I think, in the modern sense of the word, is finding your strong feeling about a cause that interests you. To find something which is your personal preference and go for it with gusto. And that's not a bad thing, but the problem with this kind of passion is that they're often provisional and exchangeable. So it's often about the flavor of the month. When I say Schaeffer was passionate, it wasn't that kind of passion. Schaeffer's passion was different. It was a strong conviction of what he knew to be true. And it had a commanding character to it that shaped everything about the man. So when I say Schaeffer was passionate, he was passionate about what he knew was true. Therefore, it was worth dying for. Now I want to highlight 3 areas where La Brie reflects Schaeffer's passionate belief. Because it's an outworking of his passion, what he was convicted by. I think firstly, La Brie reflects Schaeffer's passionate commitment to a truth lived out. His passionate commitment to a truth lived out. La Brie is the fruit of an internal conviction that Schaeffer had that was then put into action. So it was the practical outworking of something he passionately believed was true. It was a demonstration of his belief. It was the truth made visible. That's what Labrie was. Shaver had a commanding conviction that Christianity was true, true to the way things really are, that God really is there, that this God who's there is personal, that this personal God communicates with us in a clear way, and that this God has promised us that if we do things in His way and in His agency, blessing will flow. There's a way to do His work. He passionately believed these things, and the Labrie was the fruit of this passionate belief. It was the practical outworking of it. And I find it remarkable that this man, who was brilliant, was very, very practical in terms of the way he implemented what he believed was true. So I think Labrie is the fruit of Schaeffer's passionate commitment to truth. And I think this is a sober warning, perhaps for many of us. Many, as Ranald said, misunderstand Schaeffer as a theoretical man, as some kind of ivory tower intellectual. And if you read some of his books, perhaps you could mistake him for this. But actually, he was a very practical man alongside Edith. And this is reflected in Labrie, in a living community. So that's the first thing I'd say, is that Labrie is a practical demonstration of what he knew to be true. Secondly, I'd say Labrie reflects Schaeffer's passionate commitment to the full lordship of Christ. This is a phrase that goes with Labrie, commitment to the full lordship of Christ. Schaeffer was passionate about Christ's rule over all of life. If Jesus Christ really was Lord, this rule had to extend over all of life and not some tiny little part of it. And again, I think this is a good thing for us to reflect on. Too much modern Christianity is far too narrow in its feel and its reach. It suffers from a disease which we might call the churchies. It's an STD, a spiritually transmitted disease, and many Christians have this. Christians are incapable, many Christians, of seeing how Christ's lordship extends over every area of our lives. And we tend not to extend His rule beyond the walls of our church, very much locked into our own little worlds. Well, the Christ that Schaeffer loved and adored was much bigger than this. And Schaeffer was willing to live this out in establishing Labrie. So his commitment to the full lordship of Christ meant he didn't set up a Christian institute. What did he do? He took the most basic building block the Creator gave to us, the most basic social unit, which is the home and the family, and he said, I'm just going to open this basic building block open to the world. That's what he did. And he structured it as a community. And this open home was for every type of person that existed. Not just for clergymen, not just for theologians, for intellectuals from every walk of life, for druggies, for hippies, for artists, for unbelievers, for musicians, for educators, for dropouts. This home was a place for all these kinds of people. And if you come to Labrie today, and if you went back then, it doesn't feel very religious. A profound commitment to moment by moment, walking with the living Christ, but it doesn't feel religious. It's much more a microcosm of all of life. So diverse, so broad. I've worked in Labrie for 20 years, absolutely loved every moment of it. At times, it's exhausting. And I ask, why is it so exhausting? Well, it's as if the whole universe at moments converge in this place, in this open home, because there's such a diversity there. And that came out of Schaeffer's passion for Christ's full lordship. And then thirdly, I'd say Labrie reflects Schaeffer's passionate commitment to persons. He was passionately committed to persons. Labrie Fellowship is what Labrie is known by in its name. We are a fellowship. And fellowship, of course, is what occurs between persons. It's a meaningless term if you take the personal world away. Now, Schaeffer was passionate about persons. This is reflected in his strange little phrase. He had some strange phrases, didn't he? The mannishness of man. He's getting there at personhood. He's getting at the fact that the mystery of our universe is contained in the reality of persons. That's where the Imago Dei is concentrated. We are not reducible to neurons. What we are essentially as persons functions beyond the border of nature. Schaeffer was passionate in this belief. And that conviction makes Labrie something which is intensely interpersonal. It's how the place functions. Now, this is against a backdrop of a disturbing dehumanization that's occurring in our culture. Everyone today has to find their place in the machine. Modern institutions tend to be so bureaucratic. Everything reduced to what Jacques Ellul calls a technical universalism. Now, in contrast to this, Labrie is so unbureaucratic, sometimes annoyingly so. Labrie is just so homely. The core of Labrie is just simple hospitality. So ordinary in that sense. And yet in today's context, so radical. So we share long meals together as persons. We listen to each other as persons, to each other's questions. We have extended conversations with no fixed agenda. We don't have clear goals with measurable outcomes that we put into them. We're simply a space where persons meet. Now that is the legacy of Frances Anita Schaeffer. They were passionate about persons. And I think that living legacy today is so profound. And I think it's this that accounts for Labrie's disproportionate influence. We're so small, we're so fragile, and yet we've had a remarkable reach under God's blessing, under the leading of the Holy Spirit over the decades. And I think part of the accounting for this is that Labrie works with persons. It's very interpersonal, and we believe under God that it's persons and not programs that really change the world. Programs change the surface of things, but leave no lasting and substantial influence. The Schaeffers understood that and practiced it in terms of the way they set up Labrie. And I think the Schaeffers are a wonderful reminder of what a few can do if they live in a passionate commitment to truth, to Christ, and to persons. Now, I just want to finish very briefly here by saying that I think as I see this legacy of Labrie, this living legacy of Labrie that the Schaeffers left to the world that's carrying on today, I see it very much within the framework or paradigm of being a counter-order. Those of you who are familiar with the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, in his wonderful volume of work, A Secular Age, he actually ends his book by looking at the malaise of modernity. He says modernity is in crisis, and he says the only thing that can impact this crisis is what he calls counter-orders. And I think in a very small but significant way, Labrie, as handed down by the Schaeffers, has functioned as a counter-order. Now, a counter-order has two purposes. One is to act as a conscience to the church. So the counter-order, as Labrie functions, is Christian, standing under the authority of the Bible. We're one with the church. We're not a church, but we're one with the church. But part of our purpose, part of our calling, is to function as a conscience to the church and to actually challenge the worldliness of the church, to be an irritant to the church. I have good friends who are not in Labrie, love Labrie, but are completely irritated by Labrie. And I say that's part of our calling, part of our function, to be irritating to you, to function as a counter-order. The other side of the counter-order is that we're there to subvert the culture, to subvert modernity, to reflect something positive about what the good life, the flourishing life under Christ's lordship looks like. So you see the two pillars, the two wings of the counter-order to the church, challenging the church, its worldliness. This is what the kingdom of God is meant to look like. But then reflecting positively of the demonstration, something which is an alternative to the prevailing culture. That's a counter-order. And I think the Schaeffers, in a wonderful way, have left LaBrie to carry on that role with those two wings. And I just encourage you, beg you all to pray for us. We're very small, very fragile. It's how the Schaeffers set it up. As Ronald puts it, they put institutional weakness into the operating principles. They set LaBrie up for failure, so unless the Lord comes and blesses, it's going to close down. So we live in constant fragility. That's why we live the life of prayer. Please join us and pray along with us for the Lord to bless us and keep this work going. Thank you.
Yeah, whatever I said about hagiography in relation to the persons, Francis and Edith, we would just echo in relation to LaBrie, okay? Very fragile and weak organization. Greg, Dr. Greg Jessen from Iowa, please. Now, one of the things we were delighted to have in Greg being here was someone who had been influenced by LaBrie and has gone out into the secular world and carried on the kind of LaBrie ideas in that context. And that's what I just wanted to talk to Greg about. He doesn't want to use a mic, so I'm going to hold it for him. He says he doesn't need it, which is partly true. Dear Greg, tell us, what do you do, first of all?
I'm a philosopher at Luther College and also the director of the Center for Ethics and Public Life. So I bring in speakers from around the world. Had Oz Guinness last month come and speak with various speakers. And then I teach philosophy in the areas of metaphysics, which are theories of reality, epistemology, theories of knowledge, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of religion.
Now, were you raised in a Christian family?
I was raised as an atheist, and I was raised to think that religious people, there's just something kind of wrong with them. They didn't quite get it. And so I was a student at Stanford, and I had gone to study what I thought was the single most important question. I was a young idealist that had no ideals, but I was an idealist. So how that worked out, I wasn't quite sure, but I wanted to study what I thought was the single most important question in life. And so I decided that was the effect of DDT and other pesticides on the ocean's capacity to carry oxygen, because that affects the whole food chain. And so that's what I was doing in college. And the other thing I did in college was argue with Christians all the time. So in the dormitory where I lived, there was a table where if you wanted to talk seriously about anything, that's where you went. And I was arguing with Christians all the time. I had never read the New Testament, so the arguments were often very vacuous. But anyway,
that's what you did.
That's what I did, and they did have a lot of passion. Misdirected, but confused. So I had I can remember right where I was, and every time I go back to Stanford, I go to that spot. It's a kind of pilgrimage, because I had a thought one day that changed the whole direction of my life, and that thought was, I can now think of something more ultimate than the effects of DDT and pesticides on the ocean's capacity to carry oxygen. What is wrong with those people who knowingly and intentionally poison the planet that their children and grandchildren have to live on? And immediately I realized that's not a chemical problem. You know, give them some potassium, they'll be fine. I mean, I realized that's a psychological problem or some kind of cultural problem, maybe a religious problem, but something. It's not chemical. And about this time, somebody gave me one of Francis Schaeffer's books, Pollution and the Death of Man. And
fantastic.
I mean, wow, just all of a sudden, it took so much energy now to go back and study chemistry, you know, because I realized, wow, now this is giving me a framework that I just never dreamt was possible. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what was the beginning of my background and the questions I came with and how I started to see the relevance of Francis Schaeffer's work, but then even more importantly, the relevance of Christianity. So then I started studying philosophy. I was reading, of course, when you study philosophy in the beginning, you read Plato, and you know, you read these Platonic dialogues with Socrates, and he comes into town and asks, you know, what is justice, what is truth, what is virtue. And then there's some dialogue, and it goes on for about 40 pages, and half the time you're lost, and what happened to the original question, and at some point it just ends, you know? I thought, though, it was amazingly impressive. I had never seen such wit and insight and this kind of intellectual...
Had you become a Christian by this?
No, I had not. So I was reading Plato, and I liked the dialectic of the discussion. Mm-hmm. And now I thought, well, I better read the New Testament so I can argue with these Christians better, because I don't really know what I'm talking about. So I started to read the New Testament, read the Gospels, and I go, my gosh, this guy Jesus, he's kind of impressive. You know, and the thing that I was comparing him to Socrates, and if you think about it, the two pillars of Western culture are Jesus on the Jewish side and Socrates on the Greek side. And if you look at their lives, they have so many similarities. I mean, they trumped up charges, both executed for spurious reasons. Socrates claimed to be speaking the words of God. Jesus was claiming to be God in the flesh. Both asked difficult questions that people couldn't answer. Mm-hmm. You know, and it all just struck me as so interesting. Now, the one thing that really propelled me, though, was that as opposed to Socrates that took 40 pages to weave the dialectical net, it only took Jesus about 3 sentences, you know? And then it's like, what could you say? You know, I mean, you know, like in the parable of the Good Samaritan. You all know the story, of course. And who was neighbor to he who fell among the thieves? Now, what can you? I think the one who walked by and didn't even look. You know, I mean, you can't. There's only one answer you can give, right? The one who helped, right? And so that all interested me. Started reading then all of Schaeffer's books, and then of course started veering off in every direction.
Wow.
Other authors, and you know, following the footnotes and so forth. And so I wrote Schaeffer a 30-page letter with my questions on Christianity.
Wow.
And there's a nice line in Pascal where he says, "If I had more time, I would have written less." And that is really, you know, I was young and energetic, and you know, and I it was I don't know, over the top. But anyway, I got an invitation back to come and study. So I finished the semester and off I went. Then went to Switzerland, and I got there in the middle of January and in a blizzard, and so that's about
great. Now, teaching philosophy, what do you find are the really difficult questions that people throw at you in terms of it being true? So you're teaching philosophy. So in that sort of a context, what are the kind of main things that they're concerned about?
Well, I guess the two things, and Oz is going to address these a lot, but the two things I'd say are truth and knowledge. Those are the two things that are so much at being challenged in every single quarter, in especially the academic world, except for places like engineering. In engineering, you know, you can't say there's no such thing as truth. I mean, you know, if you work for Boeing, either the plane hangs on the, either the wing hangs on the plane or it falls off, you know. And you can't just say it doesn't matter how long it is when you're designing the plane. Everybody knows that. And you can't be a relativist with respect to engineering. But the humanities are almost totally gone. And in the universities in America, and I'm sure the same is true in Great Britain, truth and knowledge are a joke. Now, the thing that's so fascinating, though, and so I have students all the time who say they don't know anything. I had a student when I was teaching at the University of Southern California. She denied her own existence. She just said, I don't exist. Now, of course, what am I going to use to show her that she does? Because anything I'm going to say, she's just going to deny that she even hears me. You know, I don't hear those words you're saying, that kind of thing. And so I thought, when it came to the time to give grades, I thought, well, this now I've got her. I'm not going to give her a grade because she doesn't exist. And unfortunately, the dean was not amused. Because she complained, you know, and I tried to explain to the dean, but don't you see there's this great philosophical, you know, point here, you know, give her a grade, you know, so, but this is one of the interesting things that kind of ties it with Schaeffer. The thing that's interesting about philosophy is it's just you're trying to think really rigorously about the ultimate questions of life, and the philosophy is a completely free enterprise. You are welcome to be a philosophical fool if you want. And I describe that as, you know, in chess or in checkers. I don't know if it's true in chess. In checkers, there are two corners of the checkerboard where you can retreat. And if enough men have been lost in the game, I guess women pieces, whatever you call them. I don't want to be politically incorrect here. But if enough pieces have been lost in the game, you can retreat into one corner and just move back and forth until the other person just gives up. And that little illustration says a lot about how students often look at philosophy. It's a game, you see, and who can be the cleverest and so on and so forth. And you see, that misses the Socratic dictum. The unexamined life is not worth living. And the unexamined life is not achieved by, examining life is not achieved by taking a philosophy course, being a philosophy major, getting a doctorate in philosophy. You know? It's not achieved by owning philosophy books. It's a much deeper kind of thing. And so I find that helping students try to get hold of that look, we're talking about your life here. And we're talking about what are you going to do with your life? And how are you going to spend your life? And what's worth spending your life on? But you've got to do it in such a way that invites them to enter into the discussion, the pilgrimage, the adventure, to discover the ultimate questions of life. And so in our postmodern age, it's very hard to get students to take all of this seriously. And that, I think, is the greatest challenge. Now, I'm going to just go a little further, but, okay.
We need to type a question to answer. So,
okay.
Yeah, is it long or is it short?
Yeah, okay, Schaeffer, you see, the thing that was so great about Labrie was it wasn't about intellectual gamemanship and it wasn't about who could be the most clever and so forth. It was a community in which, first of all, you felt accepted and cared for. Okay, so, I mean, one of the things that just struck me from the beginning was at dinner, there were flowers on the table. Everybody knew your name. There was a real discussion, and you really felt cared for. Now, the very quick point is this. The most important part of our lives are those parts of our lives where we are able to say, I might be wrong. I could be wrong. I mean, just in anything. I mean, we all know that horrible feeling we have. You know, maybe you have an argument with someone you love, and you're arguing with this person back and forth, and about halfway through you realize, they're exactly right. I'm completely wrong. And you just keep arguing, you know, because you know. And so to get to that point, and just very quickly, LaBrie was the kind of place, and Schaefer was the kind of person, along with Edith, that you could actually start to entertain that thought. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. And maybe there's something, there maybe I'm wrong about Christianity. Maybe I'm wrong about the purpose of life. Maybe I'm wrong about what's the ultimate value. And so it was in that loving community that you were able to entertain these ultimate questions and not have to be right and not have to play the gamesmanship and be in, you know, retreat into the corner of the checkerboard.
So you felt he really answered the real issues that you were struggling with.
Yeah, I mean I was very young when I went, and I didn't know anything, and I remember I was working in a strawberry patch, weeding it one day, and I think it was about 18 or something, and I look up, and here's Francis Schaefer coming down the hill to talk to me. Now, I had never talked to him or anything. He always sent him a letter. I don't know if he read it or gave it to someone else, but now here he is coming down the hill to talk to me, and he just sits down in the strawberry patch and pulls weeds along with me. And, you know, wants to know about my life and who I am and what do I do and what are your questions. And it wasn't long after that here comes Edith Schaefer down the hill with a tray, with tea, biscuits and all this. It was always hard to get work done at the Schaefer's house because Edith was giving you so much tea that I would have a break every 10 minutes and then work for 15 and then another break. Or, you know, so it was
lovely.